WUWF is observing the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. Our first report explored the decades-long battle for women's suffrage, culminating with certification of the amendment on August 26, 1920. Today, we focus on the progress of women's participation in elections by voting and holding political office themselves.
Well, that was a very gradual thing, and the truth is it's still very disappointing that women are so underrepresented in political office.
This is Dr. Marjorie Spruill, retired history professor from the University of South Carolina, who's a noted authority on women and politics. Spruill says the state of Montana was one of the earliest to endorse women's suffrage and put a woman in office.
They elected a woman, Jeanette Rankin, to Congress in 1916. So she was already there, even before 1920. After 1920, the numbers of women, begins to grow, but it's gradual. And at least in Congress, it seemed like that the main way that any women got into Congress was if they were the widows of men who had died in office.
This is referred to as the widow's game in politics. Noted examples include Nellie Ross of Wyoming, who replaced her deceased husband and became the nation's first woman governor in 1925. Appointed to fill her husband's seat, Hattie Wyatt Caraway became the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate in 1932. In 1938, Crystal Byrd Fawcett from Pennsylvania became the first black woman elected to a state legislature.
It's extremely important to recognize that African-American women citizens were definitely enfranchised by the 19th Amendment in the sense that, like all women who were citizens, their rights to vote were then established. But outside the South, African-American women were very definitely voting, very active.
In the South, Spruill says state governments were intent on establishing and preserving white supremacy in politics and enacted numerous measures to suppress voter participation among blacks, even resorting to violence. Here's a clip from a Third World Newsreel documentary.
When his grandpa got shot, then everybody started shooting.
Ocoee, Florida, November 1920.
Bullets were flying through the house, and she said so many of you see the tracers of each bullet passing through.
In Florida, there was an actual riot of white citizens opposed to black suffrage who came in and killed a lot of black citizens and burned much of the town because there had been rumors that black people were planning to use that right to vote.
Moving forward in time, Spruill says the success of the African-American civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s and passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 helped embolden the modern women's rights movement. By 1970, 50 years after the 19th Amendment granted the right to vote, other women's issues were front and center.
On this anniversary, a militant minority of women's liberationists was on the streets across the country to demand equal employment for women, care centers for mothers, child abortions for anyone who wants them, and general equality between women and men.
Dr. Spruill chronicles this contentious time in U.S. political history in her book, Divided We Stand, The Battle Over Women's Rights and Family Values That Polarized American Politics.
It's focused first on the 1970s and how the rise of the modern women's rights movement in the 60s then reached a sort of a golden age in the early 70s before conservative women started to organize against it and when both political parties were solidly behind it.
This was a period marked by numerous equality gains for women in the Supreme Court and through changes in antiquated laws and policies. But not all women were on board, and a major turning point occurred in 1977 when the conservative women's movement successfully mounted a counter pro-life, pro-family rally at a women's rights event in Houston.
I'm arguing that the two rallies and the ways that they got there and everything really had the role of codifying the demands and the views on each side and then galvanizing and unifying the supporters of each side and making all of them aware that women needed to be very active in politics to stand up for their beliefs.
As a result of this activism, Sproul says women turned out to the polls in high numbers. In the 1980 presidential election, women cast votes in greater numbers than men for the first time in U.S. history.
Up until then, women's turnout had not been as high as men, but now in 1980, it exceeded that. And then it has continued to do that in every election since.
Another uptick in women's participation in politics occurred in the early 1990s after the appointment of Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court and Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment.
Many women watching all over the country believed that she had been badly treated, and many people around the country insisted that they thought she was lying, and it actually inspired a major increase in the numbers of women who ran for office, and a whole lot of them won.
There was another big increase in women running and winning in 2000, led by Hillary Clinton's election to the U.S. Senate in New York. Her loss to Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election and a rise in the Me Too movement provided another spark in political activism and resulted in the Women's March in 2017. In the midterm elections that followed in 2018, women broke records for the number of candidates for governor, U.S. Senate, and U.S. House.
We have in Congress now more women than we have had before, and certainly a more diverse group of women.
Topping it off is Democrat Joe Biden's history-making selection of California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate.
So in 2020, on the anniversary of woman suffrage, we have a woman of color who is the nominee of a major party for vice president.
Sandra Averhart, WUWF News.